Mr. King, Reel 3. We were talking about the fact that you were with your girlfriend, I believe, at Jarrow when the war broke out and had to make your way home. What were your thoughts about that particular announcement?
Well, I think my recollection, everybody was at sort of panic stations that particular morning. You know, I think nobody sort of knew what was going to happen. I mean, it was all just that everything was up in the air. Nobody knew what the war was, I suppose, what it meant. And with the air raid war and the sirens going, I think everybody felt that we were suddenly going to be deluged by bombs or something, you know. So I think that was the big problem there, of course.
Was there a feeling that this war would be similar to the last?
Well, I think people just sort of didn't realise how fast moving the war was going to be, of course, because it was all sort of embodied in the minds that it was going to be trench warfare again. I think everybody just had that trench warfare mentality.
And you, of course, were coming up to a military age. Your parents must have been a little bit concerned that you may be called.
Well, prior to the war, as it happened, I had to sign on for the 1st Militia. I think then the idea was that we were going to be kitted out in blazers and flannels, and you know, and that was going to be it, just as a sort of a first defence, I think. And I'd actually opted for the Royal Navy. When I'd gone for the interview, I went to Newcastle, I remember, and I was already serving my time as a bricklayer, as it happened. I had this interview with this big petty officer, I remember, and he said, "What do you work at?" I said, "Oh, I'm a bricklayer." He said, "Oh, there's no bricklayers in the Navy." He says, "You'll very likely get called up for the Army." So, of course, I just went on. You know, that would be 1938, I would think, something like this, before the war anyway. And hoping that I was going to be called up as soon as possible, you know, because I'd already volunteered for the Navy. He put the damper on that, of course.
So you were quite keen at the thought of joining up?
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't sort of mind, really. I was maybe looking forward to it, you know. I remember we were working at Brandon, altering some colliery houses, and everybody got the call up papers on a Thursday. And my sister worked in the chemists in Crook, and there was a big open market square, you know, where we lived. We got off the bus beside the church, had to walk sort of past the chemists, but at a distance from the chemists, up to where we lived in West End Villas. And my sister was frantically waving out of the chemist shop doorway because she knew what time I got off the bus. And she says, your papers have come. She says, I said, "Where have I to go, Portsmouth?" She said, "No, Bransford."
What date was this?
I dropped through the floor.
What date was this?
I was called up actually on the 20th of June, 1940.
And
so
up to
that would be a week or two before, I suppose. You know.
So up to that time, you'd gone through the period of the first months of the war, the Crony War.
Yeah, well, I was awake. I was working at the Corey offices, actually. We were building some Corey offices in Willington, and we were working there. And of course, we had the series of area warnings and one thing and another. And in fact, we just used to jump off the scaffold and run down into the drift, which was quite near. You know, there was a drift quite near. So, yes, we'd had some idea that there was going to be bother, but nothing ever seemed to materialise. The area warnings went and everybody dashed into the drift, and, you know, within a matter of an hour, half an hour, or an hour, or something like that. Yeah, they all played and we went off to work, and that was it. So, you know, we didn't feel any much effect, of course. There was the searchlights at night time and that sort of thing. But, you know, the war still seemed a long way off.
Dunkirk obviously occurred prior to your joining up.
Yes, yes, I missed Dunkirk, of course, but I can remember them, some of the troops coming back. But not a great deal of it. I cannot recall sort of much of a buffet sort of style, you know, much alteration of air.
Did that defeat, which is what it was at the end of the day, was that affecting people's morale?
No, I don't think it did, actually. I don't think it did. In fact, I think it did the opposite. I got the impression then, of course, as I say, I was just young, of course, myself. I maybe wasn't sort of too worried about the issue, to be honest, about morale and that sort of thing. No, I don't think. Didn't reflect on my parents, I don't think they didn't seem to think it was the end of the world, so to start.
So you got your papers, as you say, in the middle of June.
Yeah, yeah.
What were your parents' response to that?
My mother was worried. My father was a very, very quiet chap. And he didn't, he was very communicative, actually. Big sort of rough sort of fella, and but my mother was worried, naturally, of course. My sisters, had three sisters, of course, they were all worried. And I thought, I think my sisters thought that we were going to be in trenches and that sort of thing, and having memories of the First World War, of course.
You went to Bransworth Castle. What was the reception when you got there?
Well, we went to Bransworth, and it wasn't finished. The camp, the hooded camp, they were still working on it, and we went to Bransworth Castle, actually, on the call up, and we sort of kitted out in Bransworth Castle, and then I was transferred back to Willington, almost the same, maybe couple of days after, or a day after, something like that. So I was just called up to Bransworth to sort of register, really, and then I was transferred back out to Willington, of all places, because I lived in Crook, which wasn't a million miles away from home.
You said you were kitted out in the castle.
Yeah, yeah.
What uniform did you receive?
Well, we just received a basic, the khaki, of course, the battle dress and that sort of thing, and underclothes and that sort of thing. Webbing.
How were the sizes checked to see if you were right, or were they checked?
They weren't. You just sort of, bloke sort of looked at you and said, oh, you're medium, and that was it. You've got what he thought was the fit. And then, of course, you got the chance to, later on, if they were, it was apparent they weren't very well fitting. But the uniforms then, you got blokes who look terrible, some of them, because they just, sort of big blouses and little scrawny neck fellas, they looked out of place. But I got quite, of course I was maybe a medium sized fella, I suppose.
And it was issued to on just on looking at you.
Yeah.
Did they issue you with your webbing and your other equipment at the same time?
All at the same time. Yeah.
What did they give you?
Well, if I recall, we got the webbing, ammunition webbing, of course. The two pouches. We got the two of the Bren gun, as we call them, the Bren gun pouches. And the small haversack and large haversack, gas mask and gas mask case, of course. Boots, a couple of pair of boots, that was it, that was about it. Well, a great coat, of course. And then we were shipped back out to Willington and formed up into companies then, into platoons then in Willington, and just started training. As from then,
So this was your basic infantry training unit.
Yeah. Well, it was called 4ITC actually. Bransworth was called 4ITC, and then we came back out to Willington.
Where were you accommodated? In Willington?
The first couple of days, in fact, I went to the Miners' Welfare Institute, and just I think we just sort of got orientated there, and then I landed up in the British Legion, called British Legion Hall, which was above, where it was above Metcalfe's shop actually, sort of behind and above Metcalfe's shop, and that was the sort of the regular place I was in. There was other lads in the there was a big chapel almost next to the British Legion, which accommodated another platoon. There was another platoon, of course, in the welfare, and that was about it in Willington. And of course, the other companies were in Ushermoor and Eshwinning and Spennymoor, or other areas around there. Of course.
What were you sleeping on?
Oh, just palliasses, yeah, on the floor and palliasses, yeah.
How did you keep your equipment and your uniform?
Oh, it was just on the floor, of course. It should be, you know, you rolled your palliasse up and stuck it on top of your, you know, just, you know, just ready for kit inspection. You know, you were taught how to lay the kit out and that sort of thing. And had the kit inspection, of course, you know, every so often.
How many would there be in the hall with you?
About 32, I would think. About 30 to 32, more or less a platoon, each platoon, you know. And I was in a chap called the sergeant in charge of my platoon, was called Rodham, Bill Rodham. There was a one called Edgill. And there was a lad called Brownie Hodgson, who was actually local, been in the Terriers, and was a local lad. He was another platoon sergeant. One called Rafferty.
What were they like, these people?
Well, most of them, I think, had been all ex-2nd Battalion men, I think, who'd been in India. And, of course, just been sort of drafted as training instructors, I suppose. I found them all right.
They treat you all right.
Oh yeah, if I found it, I was determined right from the beginning. I wasn't going to stop a private, no way. So I made it my business to be first. When we were in the British Legion, the other sort of, we were upstairs above the shop, and used to rattle down the stairs, and I was always trying to be first out, first on parade sort of style, so I was in the front, to be well noticed, I suppose. But as I say, I was determined I wasn't going to stop the private, no way. That wasn't going to be for me. So right from the very beginning, I made my mind up I was going to get promoted somehow, one way or the other. And
so you obviously took to the discipline.
No problem. I think I was promoted after about 3 weeks to be acting Lance Corporal. Just to, used to march the lads up from the billet up to the mine, up to the welfare, where it's the Kensington Hotel now. It was one of the parish hall actually, where the meals were, the kitchens, the meals were taken there. And used to march the blokes up and down every meal time.
This was an unpaid.
Oh yeah, just acting unfair. I just sort of, you match them up, you know, and that was it, sort of style. You know.
How did you take to the language of the army?
Oh, okay. I found it okay, no problem.
It wasn't pretty bad stuff, was it? Where did you do most of your drilling?
Well, just outside in the streets, of course, up and down the street outside the British Legion, where we were, of course. The other people would do it outside their billets, of course, just marching up and down the road. That was it. You know, you marched up and down 100 yards and back 100 yards, and that was the full extent of your sort of your marching drill, and the ordinary foot drill, you just did it outside the billet, you know. And that's where, of course, everybody walking up and down heard all the I'm not saying there was, I can't remember a great deal of abuse if language mine. I think that, you know, there was the normal army stuff that you get, of course, stupid, you know, for people and all this sort of thing. But Brownie, of course, who I knew well, actually, I got to know him well. Brownie came in for the most of the abuse because, as I say, he was a local lad. And he had a particularly loud voice, in fact, you know. And many people used to play hell about Brownie, of course. The lads in Brown, that sort of thing. And in fact, I think one woman hit him over there with an umbrella one day, you know, because she was so incensed at what he was doing. But that was just one of those things, you know. One of the things I remember was a lad having a go at a sergeant called Rafferty. He was in the he was in the church, the chapel, and he had a go at Rafferty with a rifle. He tried to shoot Rafferty, that was once for all. That was one of the horrendous stories going around the, you know, the bullets. That you know, the usual thing is someone said, well, he shouldn't have really missed, you know, that sort of thing. Because Rafferty, in fact, was rather a disciplinarian as well. But the two I knew mostly, of course, Billy Rodden, and now just suit his name, Elric. They were quite reasonable sort of fellows, you know. I thought they were anyway. You know.
What kind of treatment did they dish out to you for minor misdemeanors?
Well, I think most people got just maybe 2 or 3 days jankers or something like that, you know. Mostly ended up just doing coke house fatigues and that sort of thing.
Nothing too harsh and physical?
I don't remember anything too harsh or physical, to be honest, no. Just mostly confined to barracks or where they couldn't confine the barracks much, to be honest. Because you know, it wasn't sort of a closed barracks, but mostly people just got jankers.
Were they friendly towards you when you were off the duty situation, off the parades and the drills? Did they mix with you very much?
No. I think most of the off time, the off duty, which didn't influence me greatly because I didn't drink at that time. But was just in the local pubs, so I would imagine the sergeants and corporals, or the sergeants mostly, would get into one pub, because there was no sergeants' mess, as I remember. There was an officers' mess. The officers had the mess in the Market Hotel, upstairs in the Market Hotel, which was known as Mrs. Ginty's, actually. And they had a big room upstairs there. With the sergeants, I cannot recall them having a separate sergeant's mess.
Did you see much?
Most of the fraternisation, I think, was just done in the local pubs.
Did you see much of the officers?
No, not a great deal. Hardly at all, in fact, if I recall. There was somebody up there, you know. We didn't seem to get much officer input into the training. It seemed to be almost left entirely to the sergeants, in fact, you know.
You'd spend quite a bit of your working life, of course, with men away from home, or building sites and what have you, so presumably you wouldn't find a great difficulty mixing with men in this close situation.
It didn't bother me at all, in fact.
What were they like, the group of men that you were first with?
I got the impression that quite a few of them were quite a lot older than me. There seemed to be a lot of people who were, not a lot, there was a few people who were entirely misfits, who had been called up and were just either physically or mentally incapable of being even thought of as soldiers. There was one in particular who just used to go, he lived in Wellington, as it happens, and he just used to go home any time you just wander home, you just used to come up at his store and say, hey, come lad, come back. I mean, eventually got discharged, but you know, there were a few at that time that were just so just actual misfits altogether. You know, whoever sort of sent them to the army must have had no idea what sort of army training was going to be like, or whether they were going to be fit for training. Because, as I say, there's one or two in particular who, well, they had no idea, of course.
Were these mentally and physically?
Just mentally, mentally and physically, in fact, but more mentally, in fact, quite one or two. Although, my later on, in my army career, I found one or two that way, certainly, but when I had to deal with them, in training in particular, they had no idea, of course, and some of the poor lads, of course. And of course, they were found out, of course, eventually, and either sent into the coke house or languished in the coke house until nothing else would, you know, scrape the spoons or something like that. But they hadn't any sort of meaningful army career at all, you know.
Was there any bullying or initiation in your group?
No, I can't remember any at all. Later on in my in career, I did see some element of that. But not as trainees. In fact, everybody was almost, you know, by the time they did all the route marching and the training and the cleaning and polishing and that sort of thing, I think it was 13 weeks they did as an initial training. Could have been, I think, about 13 weeks. Might have been 16. Everybody was sort of on the knees a lot of the time. And couldn't be bothered bullying people, to be honest. But of course, they then started getting a bit pride in the uniform, I suppose, and you know.
Could you take me through a typical day in that training stage of your career? Say, what time was Reveille?
Reveille was, I remember, 6:30. We used to march the blokes up to the. Because they hadn't a muster parade as such then. The first parade, of course, as I recall, was sort of parading for breakfast. And we used to march them up to the parish hall for breakfast. And then after breakfast, I think the first parade would be maybe a drill parade, 3/4 hour, about 8:30. And then you would do weapon training maybe for 3/4. They were sort of set into sort of 3/4 hour periods, you know, something like that. Then you did physical training, of course, for 3/4 hour. And then brain gun training, of course, being a drill and all that sort of thing. So it was sort of split up into sort of 3/4 hour periods. And then, of course, at night time, well, they were picking duties and guard duties, of course, that people had to become accustomed to.
Can we go through that with a little bit more detail? You woke, as you say, Reveille at 6:30. Was this bugle?
Yeah. In Willingdon, you had bugles, yes.
And immediately you would get up and presumably dressed and washed and so forth. What about making beds and cleaning?
I can't recall the much bugle training at Willingdon. Might have been in Bransworth. I think it would be in Bransworth. But at Willingdon, we just got shouted at, you know, somebody, as we knew him then, was the Army Sergeant, where all the Army Corps would come on and, you know, get everybody out of bed. But it was 6:30.
And then, having washed and so forth, you would presumably have to clean up the room?
Oh, yes. We had, you used to have a barrack room orderly nominated every day.
What was his task?
Well, his task was to keep the room tidy during the day, because what used to happen, of course, blokes used to dash in, you maybe have 10 minutes to change in between one period and another. And they used to dash in, and of course, stuff was left tumbled about, lying about, and he had the job of keeping the room tidy. And nearly always, the barrack room orderly was one of these blokes that wasn't fitting the bill. You know, he was the the lad that just kept the place tidy, and Sam just sort of looked the other way when he
Did you all have a role in keeping the room clean itself,
well,
overall?
Oh yes, everybody had jobs.
How was that?
Well, there was a rota, duty roster, you know, posted every day. Six would go to the coke house, six would go somewhere, you know, you would have different sort of duties, you know. So there would be a duty roster, you know. And then, of course, you had... depending on what you were doing next day, you had the grenades to clean and that sort of thing. You know, if you're throwing grenades as a duty, you had all the grenades to clean, and that was on mostly after you finished your normal duties, of course. That was at night time before you did anything else. So it was a full day, there's no question about it, you know.
And presumably you'd have the floors of your billet to clean, and was that by brush, or did you have to polish it? Or?
No, I mostly polish, actually. But
was that a hands and knees job?
A hands and knees job, but I can't recall much of sort of physical polishing like that, to be honest. Because they were just old buildings, you know, they were just, chapel halls, and the one we were in, of course, in the only good floor was the welfare hall, which was used to be a dance floor. Which was sort of highly polished, but other than that, I think you just sort of swept and kept it clean, you know. Yeah.
Then you said you rolled your palliasse up on a morning, and then you put
it was rolled up in like three rows, and the roll was sort of facing the room, you know, the middle of the room, and then you had your pack, your big pack on the top, you know, your the other arms on the other webbing on the other side, water bottle and all that sort of thing, you know, showing, you know, so it was open for inspection. In fact, you know, everything was sort of laid out, you know,
in a set pattern.
Yeah.
How many inspections might you get in a week, say?
Oh, I think mostly just one. Just, well, you've got an inspection every day. The sergeant used to come round every day. And then you used to get the officers come round maybe twice a week or something like that, if I recall.
Was there much thievery going on? Did people lose items of equipment too?
No. Well, if you did lose it, of course, you had to replace it. It came out of your pay, of course, yeah. It was invented out of your pay. But no, there wasn't a great deal of that sort of thing going on.
One of the subjects, since you've mentioned, how much pay did you get?
I think, if I remember rightly, I got 5 shillings. I'm almost sure my first wage was either 7 shillings or 5. Might have been 5 shillings, I think.
Had you made an allowance from your wage for home?
No, at that time I hadn't, no.
Barrack room damages, was that taken out of your wages?
That was taken out of your wages, yeah.
And that would be taken out of everyone's?
That was a sore point, that, of course, yes, because everybody suffered if there was any barrack room damages. And of course, there's nothing you could do about it. There was no sort of means of complaining and saying, well, I don't think that's right. I mean, that was it. If word came round that the barrack room damage was X amount, that was it. But we didn't seem to get any excessive barrack damages in that sense, mind. I cannot recall any sort of fatal loss of money of the income through barrack damages, you know.